Welcome to the Reaction podcast, hosted by me, Ian Martin, from Reaction. Delighted I'm joined by Max Mitchell today from the Reaction team, who is a product of the Young Journalist program that we run. And I think, Max, this is the first time we're talking just ahead of Tory Party conference and then Labour Party conference. This is the first party conference season that you've ever been to?
It is indeed. I'm much looking forward to it. It's something I've been wanting to do for quite some time, but never had the opportunity or the reason to go.
Well, I'll be fascinated to see what you think about it, because I'm sounding very old. My first ones were in the mid 1990s, and they have changed a hell of a lot. But it's still, and also the locations changed, of course, because they, in those olden days, they were in, it tended to be in Blackpool every other year, or one of the two parties was in Blackpool, which I always liked because you felt as though the parties were getting out into real England or a different kind of England. And it's now much more corporate, as you'll see, though most of the corporate interest this time is in the Labour Party. It'll be interesting to see how many corporates and others actually turn up to the Conservatives. But then we're off to the Tories on Sunday, and the Tories are 20 points behind in the polls. And if you're a betting man at the moment, it looks like a thumping Labour majority. I see some of the polling among your peers, among younger voters, the numbers are becoming almost amusing in just in terms of how pro-Labour they are and how few are considering voting Conservative. Why is that at the moment? Is it just the spectacle that the show the Tories have put on for the last 5 years, or is it about generation rent? What's your interpretation?
Well, it's not really popular with young people to hold Conservative views. It's you'd rather keep quiet about it sometimes. I definitely know that was the case at university, especially on the student newspaper. It seems to, young student journalism seems to attract people who veer left anyway. And I think that's true of the wider culture in universities and young people generally. But I think young people have felt that the hard edge of COVID, and they feel like they have had a tough time of it. There wasn't really any support or reward for putting the country first and for dealing with it quite peacefully. I know there was a couple of sunny days at the beach that went a bit wrong, but for the most part, young people were quite well behaved. But I think it's just indicative of 13 years of Tory rule that have gone quite poorly. And that for young people, 13 years is half their life. That's what they know. Mm. And so they can't remember a time under a Tory government where things were flourishing or looked like they might end up flourishing.
Yeah, a big problem that the Tories have, and talking to a senior Conservative earlier today, who was making a very similar point, saying, look, when's the last time that you actually felt right? Okay, feel hopeful about the country. Now, actually, I'm pretty hopeful about the country's medium and long-term economic prospects, but that makes me possibly unusual at the moment. But I know what he means. You have to go back to, of course, 2010. You had post-financial crisis, and you had the beginnings of what was termed austerity, but you did then have the Olympics experience, and there was this, for all those of us who were sceptical about it at the time or in the run-up to it, it felt like an optimistic time, doesn't it? If you'd been asked to cast 10 years ahead, you wouldn't really have predicted, we certainly wouldn't have predicted pandemic, probably not Brexit, and the economic problems that there have been globally since. So there's no doubt that the country's on a bit of a downer. To what extent do you think it's the property question, though? Is it massively really about rent?
I think so. I think it really is. I think it is as simple as that. Young people are not going to be in a position to buy their own homes for a long, long time. It's getting pushed back all the time. And I think the obvious way for people to show their frustration is that at that is to vote Labour. I'm not sure that Labour can actually do anything better than the Tories on that front, unless they're going to build more. I don't see that happening, but it does just come down to the property question. I mean, young people culturally as well, as I said at the beginning, young people, young conservatives, you know, there's memes made about young conservatives, about, you know, spotty young Tory boy who, you know, wears his dad's tweeds and, you know, you don't exactly want to hang around with him.
Mind you, that was the, that I know you know your history, but that was the case for in political culture in the 1990s or 1980s. I suppose it was through a more kind of aggressive prism in the 1980s, but there was a mockery. But the numbers do, the numbers are now very striking in the polls in terms of intending to vote conservative, age between the age of 18 and 24. It's not many people. What are you looking forward to about conservative conference, if anything?
Good question. I think I'm just looking forward to seeing how it operates, because it's such a totemic event, especially now that we see the way that next year's election looks like at the moment. It might throw things into sharp relief, as to a swan song. It could be a swan song.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you feel that the Tories are on the way out, and it might feel like there's that sort of panic. There's a feeling that, you know, they don't quite know what they're doing, and they know they're on the way out, and it won't be celebratory in any way.
Certainly not. The person who, of course, is most keen to challenge that interpretation of events is the Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, who, I think from what we read, sees this as a chance to, politicians hate the word relaunch, but to reset and to attempt to make some kind of connection. Now, he's going to have one particular problem is the rail strike, which we've written about on Reaction, which is deliberately aimed at messing up Conservative Party conference. Now, how does it do that? There are strikes on the day that many people are trying to get to conference and on the day of the Prime Minister's speech, which is the Wednesday, and there are overtime bans in between. So I think the aim, perish the thought that the unions are deliberately targeting it, but it seems pretty well targeted, designed to just create frustration and annoyance amongst the ruling class trying to get there, and lobbyists and business, and to say nothing of members and
absolutely
activists.
Absolutely. And as you say, party conferences have become far more corporate, so they know that it's everyone getting from London.
Yeah.
They're not, party conferences don't actually reach the people anymore. They're not too bothered about strikes coming from Edinburgh or Glasgow or Bristol or Leeds or Newcastle. They're just trying to hit all the think tank lot that are coming up for a jolly at the weekend.
Well, to any think tankers who are working very hard putting together events, and there are hundreds of events at conferences, it's not it's not just a jolly, is it?
No,
okay,
there,
but it is. But it is a bit of a jolly.
Yeah, and people are, of course, allowed a jolly. Working so hard the rest of the year,
even at Conservative Party party conference, and there are people coming who are not from London, but I think it is designed to just create this sense of decay. I'm going to be really interested to see what Sunak's speech is like, and it is. People used to boringly say, "Well, he has to make the speech of his life," and it's not that. But it will be. It'll just be interesting to see how he pitches himself.
Do you think he'll be looking over his shoulder at all after Suella Braverman's speech the other day? And many of the takes after that was that it was really a veiled attempt at a fresh leadership bid.
Yeah, I suppose in this strange era of modern politics we have now, where everything is about individual brands rather than teamwork or some teams of rivals, politics has become about brand building and Instagram memes and how they construct their own personal reputation. You think of Angela Rayner, or you think of Wes Streeting, or you think of Suella Braverman, or all sorts of figures in contemporary politics. That's the way to do it. Or Penny Mordaunt is another good example. On this case, maybe I'm being naive on the migration speech. I didn't see it or read it like that, because she's the Home Secretary. She was invited to make a speech. People said, why is she doing it in Washington? Well, she was invited to go to Washington. She made a speech. And it didn't actually, even for all the outrage that it caused, not that difficult, different from a speech that was delivered by, well, several figures in New Labour who were immigration minister or Home Office ministers. And Tony Blair himself made some similar observations about refugee status and how the courts work and how lawyers work in relation to it in his memoir, A Journey, where he's actually his analysis of it is very astute. But isn't it revealing that a woman with migrant heritage saying things which are not that different from things said by white male politicians for the last 20 years about how intractable the problem is regarded by, I know it's only Twitter or whatever it's called now, regarded somehow as the end of the world.
Mm. Particularly by young people. Young people feel really strongly against the Tory stance on stopping the small boats.
Mm.
You see everywhere in pubs where young people go, in the toilets or in student unions, no one is illegal.
Yeah.
I think that's one of the main cultural sticking points for young people. They just completely disagree with this idea that that we have to restore our borders, or that the borders exist. The young person who veers in any way left will have no time for that sort of, not just Braverman's rhetoric, but the philosophy that underpins it. Mm. And I think, yeah, if you ask young people, well, if people coming into our country, there's a finite amount of resources.
Yes.
The pie isn't getting bigger. As we've spoken about, under 13 years of Tory rule, it's been a time of relative stagnation.
Hasn't been great economically. Yeah.
No, it hasn't. And so you question to what extent we can actually, you know, help give people proper lives, and everything's getting squeezed. But it's a part of cognitive dissonance of young people. They hate it from a cultural point of view that you would enforce strong borders, but it might actually benefit them materially, but they don't really take that into account.
Mm. I do find the ultra open borders position not just baffling, but interesting. There must be some kind of limit. I mean, I wrote about it in the Times this week. And I was advocating a Marshall Plan for Africa and helping North African states, because we're at the beginning of this process. It's barely even started, with potentially huge numbers of people on the move, as the Italian government points out, and the French, Macron, pointed out that he wasn't condemned in the way that Braverman was. This is a 10, 20, 30, 40, 50-year crisis which connects Africa. And I think just so much of our debate and discussion in the UK is myopic and small.
I think and so.
We see it through the prism of just the small, turning back small boats. People, you'll hear it said in conversations. People say, "Well, just turn the boats back." Well, what does that mean? Does that mean you actually take the people from the boats and then dump them back on a beach in France, as though, and the French are obviously not going to accept that, it's dangerous and you know, impractical. The thing goes right back to source, which is enormous demographic shifts and tens of millions, potentially hundreds of millions of people being on the move in the next 30, 40, 50 years. And the only longer term answer is investment and infrastructure to
absolutely
to improve the lot of those countries, and simultaneously European states, UK included, having to invest properly in the Med and, for want of a better phrase, fortifying the Med. And it just seems that politicians, I mean, I understand it's not likely to be a popular message, is it? This is subject to deep long-term forces, and it's going to require the West, for want of a better term, engaging long-term in Africa and spending an absolute fortune. It is very difficult to sell compared to stop the boats. But what we're doing on both sides of the political divide, I don't think Labour will do anything particularly different, clearly doesn't work.
It's unsustainable, absolutely. And we have a moral duty as well to make sure that these plans are thought through, that we're not just saying, I'm all right, Jack, because that will come back to bite us.
Yeah.
We don't exist in that vacuum. And we need some sort of old-fashioned diplomacy and statecraft where our politicians actually feel like, you know, we can play on a world stage and make those sorts of things happen. We feel a bit powerless at the moment, even if we had the idea for a Marshall Plan. And it almost feels like, you know, British diplomats and politicians wouldn't feel capable or wouldn't take up the mantle to lead such a charge.
I did speak to a politician who said he's pushed similar ideas and really got nowhere with the system for many years, and yeah, maybe it is impossible. In the politicians, of course, it's easy for me to say, why don't they just tell the truth about these things directly, about the scale of the challenge to the voters? But maybe the voters are not necessarily, or not enough voters are in the mood to handle it. We're going to move on now to a discussion I had earlier with George Trefgarne. George Trefgarne, who's a veteran journalist, old friend of mine, now with Boscobel, a consultant working with industry. And George wrote a piece for his clients, which I spotted and just thought it was so clever and intelligent, on the HS2 crisis that we ran it. Been read by a lot of people in the last week, so I thought we should have a conversation. So welcome, George.
Hello, Ian.
So you wrote the piece which went out to your clients first, and I was lucky enough to republish it, and it's been very widely read, and you seem to have got to the heart of something that went wrong with the project. Tell me a bit about the background, because you were writing in praise of an old friend who you think was vindicated in his original analysis of the problem.
So I used to work with a chap called Mark Bostock, who was the person who essentially built HS1. I don't mean by the fact that he put the spades in the ground, but he is the one who drove it when he worked at Arup, for the government to adopt the alignment or the route from St Pancras for HS1 or the Eurostar link down through the east of London, through Stratford, and across the Channel. And I was working with him because we were brought on board because he was promoting something called Heathrow Hub, which was a plan to have a railway station north of Heathrow that HS2 would have gone through, and also to extend the runway at Heathrow instead of having a third runway. Now, I was brought in, I have to confess, after the HS2 element of the row, so I'm not, wasn't as involved in that as perhaps I might have been. But Mark died last month, a very distinguished, you know, civil engineer, effectively. And so when I saw the rumpus about HS2 going on, it made me remember all the things he used to say about what they'd got wrong. And the principal thing they got wrong is the wrong route. He said it should have gone up the M40 corridor, in other words, a bit further south than it does now, not through the biggest and widest part of the Chilterns. The M40 corridor is obviously an existing transport route, so it has far less environmental damage, and that you should avoid having terminal stations. You should have through stations. And although this would make the service slower by having this particular route, He said the advantage would be significantly cheaper. It would go via Heathrow, so it would take people off short-haul routes, and then it would connect with HS1 north of St Pancras.
Mm. And the point being that they became obsessed, you think, or it is said, by the concept of speed and trying to run Europe's fastest railway, Europe's fastest trains, which of course then introduced a wholly different kind of line, which had to be straighter, had to run a different route, and from there the costs were always going to be greater.
So the key thing about the speed is, in order to get ministerial approval for any project, you've got to demonstrate an economic case, in particular that its economic benefits will outweigh the cost. By increasing the speed to 400 kilometres per hour, they were able to say that the economic benefits for every 1 minute that was saved would be about £600 million on the journey time. So that hugely elevated the benefit, the economic benefits notional from the project. Why this quite happened, I wasn't fully involved at that point. I thought in the aftermath, particularly with the Airports Commission, we were working very closely with. And you could see how these models work that the Department of Transport uses. They're based on the Green Book. And they're frankly completely, they're not very good models, to be entirely honest with you. But that was one of the reasons that speed was very important. And the other thing was, I think, which is a presentational one, I think that the government at the time, I think it was Lord Adonis, and then subsequently George Osborne, David Cameron, etc., just loved the attraction of having a fast railway because it sounded good and it meant they'd get them off the hook of having to expand Heathrow.
Mm.
So they thought.
Do you think, is there a thread running through some of these major disasters in public procurement and policy making in the UK? Now, you hear it said Britain can't do anything, can't build anything. On one level, that's complete nonsense. Obviously, I'm sitting recording this at in a very nice studio in King's Cross, which has been regenerated thanks to, you mentioned the role of your friend in the regeneration of St Pancras, or recreation of St Pancras as a station.
Yeah, Mark Bostock, yeah.
Yeah. What's happened since then, since the creation of Eurostar around here, is quite extraordinary. So, of course, we can still do some of this stuff. The Elizabeth Line obviously works. Crossrail, there are other projects in other parts of the country, but some people would say it's not a coincidence that the projects I've just mentioned are in London. So it's not true in every single case, but is there a public policy failure, something wrong in the system, which means this is more likely to happen when you look at HS2 and a slew of other problems? I mean, I'm captivated by this estimate for the restoration of the House of Commons, which is somehow going to cost £22 billion. We can maybe come on to that in a moment, because there are alternatives. But what's wrong with our system?
So I think the first thing that's wrong with our system is it's just become too complicated. There are so many overlaying acts of Parliament that it's almost impossible for any individual to... it's a bit like the correspondence of Philip II of Spain, where supposedly no one has ever read the entire output. It's just incredibly complicated to get these things through. The second thing is political turmoil, where you have endless different ministers in charge of these things and civil servants. So you have multiple changes of leadership. New people always have to be brought up to speed. Then they bring their own opinion to bear. And the other thing is lack of economic realism. In the end, rather than gold-plating things, it's better just to have something relatively simple that works and is cost-effective, and that you've got an economic model that demonstrates that is the case, and consequently it can be financed partly by the private sector, ideally.
A very wise peer, when we were discussing HS2 earlier today, drew the comparison with the restoration of Parliament, which I mentioned is the bill is £22 billion now. So presumably, if this goes ahead as it seems to be, then it's going to take 25 years, five parliaments in total, and cost £22 billion. And of course, the price will then rise. His explanation was that we tend to begin these projects, and Parliament in particular, by imagining what's our perfect Parliament would look like with every piece of restoration done perfectly, And of course, if you try to restore your house or do up your house in that spirit, you'd end up with an enormous bill, which would be unaffordable. Rather than working out...
Sorry, lots of people end up in that position, as you know.
It has been in a low interest rate...
in the cloud, yeah.
In a low interest rate environment, that has been a national way of doing business, but maybe with higher interest rates, it's out of fashion. But that you pick the perfect, the best of everything, rather than saying, right, okay, what's the list of priority repairs, which actually is the more traditional approach to property, and you work through them, and perhaps Parliament gives those in charge of the project £500 million to begin with and says, right, okay, do the first of your urgent repairs and then come back to us if you hit a snag or there's a bigger undertaking, but the priority is to stop the place burning down because it is very old and the electrics are very rickety, all understand that. And I think he's onto something there.
Yes, he is onto something. And the reason is threefold, really. The first thing is that when you gold plate everything or you go for the best possible thing, it leads to complexity. And the complexity makes the costs go up. But it also leads to the next thing, which is delay, which also makes the costs go up. And the third thing it leads to is a change of leadership because no one sticks around for the whole project. So when you look at the Jubilee line, for instance, essentially that was really driven by Michael Heseltine, 20 or 30 years ago. But he was there and was powerful enough and was in office long enough to really push it through. And that's exactly what happened, exactly what you need, because you've got to have, essentially only one or two people in charge of it for the bulk of the project.
Do you share the belief of some people? I mean, Dominic Cummings has the most possibly extreme interpretation of this, but do you share the view that there is something so wrong with the system, the way that officialdom works, the rapid turnover, that some sort of major reform is required in the civil service and the way that politics is conducted?
I do, but I don't think that reform should be probably as radical as Dominic Cummings would think, because I think he'd think that Parliament should be burnt down anyway. So, but what I think is essentially you need a public-private partnership model for dealing with all large infrastructure projects. So that is the economic model. It then must become financeable, so it's got to have a clear economic case that is understood and underwritten by the government. And then you must pick projects that are as simple as possible and can be delivered as simply as possible. And that is what I think you should do.
I should stress that I don't think Dominic Cummings literally advocates the burning down of Parliament. I think it's more a metaphorical sort of turn of phrase, isn't it? But George Trefgarn, thank you very much for joining us and shedding light on the HS2 disaster.
It's a pleasure.
That was George Trefgarn talking to me earlier about HS2. Just quickly before we sign off, Max Mitchell from Reaction, who's joined me this week for the Reaction podcast. The US debate between the Republican contenders, you watched it so we didn't have to, and then wrote something about it. What was your broad conclusion? Of course, Trump wasn't there.
So the main guy,
Donald Duck, as he was called by Chris Christie, I think.
Yes. That really sucked out all the energy of it. It seems to be a perfect tactic for Trump. He can say, I'm not going to bother going into a hostile environment, talking to people who aren't really my competitors. There's not really a competition here, 40 points ahead in the polls. I will go to a rally in Michigan and, make myself look like I'm actually with the workers, with the people of America. Without Trump, you really did feel like everyone was fighting for scraps, some fighting harder than others. You felt like there was some... Nikki Haley really shined through. The stars, DeSantis and Vivek Ramaswamy, they didn't make any grave errors, but they really didn't feel like competitors. And there was an initial rise with Vivek Ramaswamy after the first debate. He climbed up to 12-13% on a par with DeSantis, but you don't feel like he can go further than that.
I realized the other day, because a friend pointed it out with a sense of horror, that I had reviewed Ramaswamy's book from 2021, Woke Inc., and that I'd reviewed it actually rather reprovingly. I actually quite enjoyed reading the book. I didn't know then that he was going to run for president in the rather strange, quixotic way that he is. Of course, Maggie Pagano of Reaction did from the start say, that guy's running, he is running, obviously running to try and be Trump's pick for vice president. But as it stands then, there's no prospect, unless something changes dramatically, of another Republican stopping Trump. Looks as though he's the nominee.
It doesn't look like it. I don't think anyone will stop him. Vivek Ramaswamy, there's been some chatter that he might be Trump's running mate on a what looks like an unbeatable dream card for the Republicans.
Yeah, depends how you define that. Yep.
Yes. However, he has said himself that he wouldn't play second fiddle to anyone and that he would rather just go back into his entrepreneurial biotech business and he can make more happen from that.
Don't buy it for a second, because the moment, I mean, in one way it's the most useless job in the world, being vice president of the United States, but you are, it's a cliche because it's true, one heartbeat away from the presidency, and particularly considering the legal jeopardy that Trump is in and is going to continue to be in. I bet you he would absolutely, he would jump at it. So we'll see. So we head off to Conservative Party conference, and then the following week off to Labour, but in the interim, we'll be back in the studio with a Reaction podcast. I'm Ian Martin of Reaction. If you're not a subscriber to Reaction, Reaction subscribers get my weekly newsletter on politics, geopolitics, culture, economics. You go to the website www.reaction.life, sign up, and it tends to be mailed out on a Saturday morning. But you also get the daily briefing from the team, from Max and his colleagues, and columnists including Tim Marshall, Maggie Pagano, all sorts of great writers. So well worth the £80 a year or £8 per month. Become a Reaction subscriber. But thank you for listening to the Reaction podcast.